Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors 2.0. Today, I talk with Canadian film director Carl R. Hearn about his debut feature film, a brilliant little one called Touched. We talk about his artistic process and how he approaches the subject material of the film with his young actor that is in it. I also speak with a band all the way from Paris, France, Dot Legacy. I speak with one of the members, Damien Quintard, about what it was like coming over from Paris to play a show in Toronto and whether they feel like they are finally born. So first, here is my interview with Carl R. Hearn. I'm here with Carl R. Hearn. He's the writer-director of Touched. Hello, Carl. How are you doing today? Adjusting to this wintry Toronto weather that we find ourselves in all of a sudden?
when I landed, it was good. And now it's coming down. Adjusting.
Yeah. So let's talk about Touched. I know it had its premiere in Montreal last month, and it's, I think, premiering in Toronto this week, starting next week?
Yeah, it's tomorrow. So Friday, I think tomorrow's the 16th, yeah. At the Carlton Cinema.
But you ought to be, I know you, for a while, you spent, you sort of took this film around to festivals. Festivals can always be an interesting experience for a filmmaker, especially for a film coming from Canada. What was this festival experience like for you with this particular film?
Every festival, we were at about 15 festivals this year, and every festival is its own little world. So, they were all really good in different ways, you know. I mean, we were at a festival in Germany where part of the festival, they have a program where you can screen your film in a maximum security prison. And I was in that prison and interviewed by a convicted murderer. I was put in a cell with him. And I had to answer questions for, you know, half an hour. A little bit like this, you know. In fact, he was looking at me in very much the same way you're looking at me. So we were at a festival in Bilbao in Basque Country. That was incredible. That was one of the few. The film is not exactly, it's not a full-on genre film at all. I mean, it has a little genre element to it. So this was one of the few genre festivals that invited us. It's called Fant Bilbao, and incredible, incredible festival. In the Pyrenees, you know, so in San Sebastian, they were so welcoming. I mean, they set up a huge press conference. They had media from all over Spain attending. And just, you know, just an amazing, amazing festival experience. So, you know, I'm not sure people are even aware that it's a Canadian film necessarily sometimes. I mean, sometimes it's marked in the program or what have you, but they just know it's an English language film. I think sometimes they assume that means it's American, yep. You know. And the festival experience, and you know, there were many more. At a few festivals, we won prizes, and you know, I could go on and on. But there's a lot of festivals, and they were really cool.
When you mentioned the maximum security prison, that really interests me because it feels like throughout the film, Gabriel is almost in his own type of self-imposed prison. Did when you were sitting across from this murderer, did that sort of play into your mind at all, that you're almost sort of inhabiting your lead character in a way?
It didn't, because the guy was so different. It's a great question, but you would have to be face to face with this guy, and this was a very charming sort of what the prison guard described as a textbook sociopath. Very charming, very intelligent, doesn't seem to feel any empathy for anyone. And Gabriel is very much, he's very different from that. So for that reason, but I was curious to see what all of these convicted murderers felt about this, you know, this this murder mystery. I didn't get to speak to them, unfortunately, after the film, so I never found that out. But yeah, I would definitely, I wouldn't say that necessarily it's self-imposed, because Gabriel doesn't want to be in this prison, but I totally agree with you that he is in a prison. Absolutely. He is locked away from all of society. I think even though Gabriel isn't someone that you naturally relate to, because he seems to have some mental issues maybe, and it's not really clear what's going on with him, the part that hopefully people can relate to is solitude and his loneliness. Mm. I mean, that aspect, I think everyone has experienced.
Service. Thank you, Ingrid. You know, we're seeing a lot of stories these days that are maybe, you know, changing the idea of what it means to be a hero. And it strikes me that Gabe maybe almost falls more into kind of the anti-hero vein a little bit. Like, he doesn't necessarily really want to be where he's at, you know. When you were sort of, you know, plotting this movie out and writing it out, was that a direction you knew you were always going to take, or how much of that came out of Hugh's performance?
Oh yeah, I mean, anti-hero, yeah, definitely, he's definitely in that direction for sure. It's not, I mean, it depends on your perspective when you're watching it, whether what he does is heroic or not. But for me, to some extent, it is, you know. I mean, he believes he's doing something. The only problem lies in if he's misguided in that, and, you know, people are getting punished who maybe shouldn't be, you know. I mean, that's, you know, certainly operating in a vigilante style, but yeah, that was very much, I mean, that's the script, and that's the story. But Hugh was amazing, I think, in executing that, and he was great to work with. So
as someone who comes from an acting background, I you know, I talk to teachers about this, especially on stage, the hardest thing I think for an actor to do a lot is nothing. And I think both Hugh and Lola were very good at transferring because in a way the film was very minimalist to me. I think both in, you know, in setting and just the emotions of the characters, and that's always difficult to do. How much direction did you have to give them in that regard, or did they just, you know, the camera rolled and they were just there?
Well, for me, most of directing is choosing the right person, is casting. So I would say that after that, like, if you've chosen the right person, and I think Lola and Hugh were the right people, after that it's really more just minor adjustments and collaborating. Probably the trickiest part was with Hugh. We didn't have a lot of rehearsal time. We had a few days or maybe a week before we started the shoot to try to get on the same page. I mean, if you read a script like this, there's so many ways you could interpret this character. You could be, you know, you could be like Rain Man, you know, you could be, you know, this full-blown angry psychopath. I mean, there's so many different directions to go, and getting on the same page is just how much of this nuance, how much of this feeling. You know, the title of the film, Touched, comes from the idea of being touched in the head, which is usually a euphemism in the past for being mentally challenged. But this was not someone who was so mentally challenged that he couldn't operate. It was more like he had some sort of thing that makes him a little different from other people. That's easy to say, but how do you portray
right.
that? And so we definitely, you know, it was a fight. Not between us, but just a fight for us to sort of, in a very short amount of time, get to where we both felt, okay, this, we're onto something. And I felt we somehow together managed to do that in just 5 or 6 days, right before the shoot started. And after that, I mean, it's really just, you know, trusting each other. And, you know, even someone as experienced as Hugh wants to you know, he can't see himself, and so he's, you know, is that the right vibe? And, you know, for the most part, I didn't have to do very much. I mean, because Hugh was just terrific. One of the most veteran members of the crew, guy who's been on, you know, 100 shoots, came to me at one point, the sound recordist, and he, Marcel, was another terrific crew member, and he said, you know, just, wow, I've never seen anyone so precise. That was the word he used, and it really stuck with me, because if you said something to Hugh, he could just hit that shade immediately. It was very precise. So, and then Lola was really cool, because she would just come in, and with a younger actor, you don't know what to expect, and she would just, was super serious, professional, and handled herself very much like an adult, even though she was only like 11 or so at the time. And, you know, had everything down, and, I mean, I think we have a shot from her from the behind the scenes where she's like raising her hand to speak to the director. I don't think you could ask for more than that.
Right, yeah.
You know, she was really cool. Her mom was super cool, and it was a great, experience working with her, you know?
You touched on the title, which is Touch, and I really like it because it, given that the film is predominantly about this man and a young girl, a lot of people think, oh, it could be an allusion to something else, right? How, in terms of sort of the pacing and the reveal of everything that happens, how cognizant and careful were you in that regard, and sort of allowing the audience to realize what this relationship may or may not be, if that makes sense?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure. I mean, something that I was aware of the whole time, absolutely, and it's definitely, you know, I mean, even now, I think to some people, it's a disturbing relationship. I think it was handled in such a way that you pretty quickly, if you're clued in, you pretty quickly realize this is not, you know, sexual, this is not, you know, perverted or what have you. But for sure, I mean, for sure, that is, like, there's a lot of details that could lead you down that path. So no, that was something I was cognizant of from the beginning, and, you know, I think we avoided it successfully, but I mean, if you look at a picture, I mean, in some of the pictures, it's the two of them sitting on the floor. You may or may not notice there's a chain behind her. It's not clear in, let's say, some of the poster images that she's chained to the wall, but I mean, that would certainly be where you would go, and then combine that with the title. But I think once you start watching the film, you realize, you know, this is not the idea.
You know, you mentioned that Lola, one of your leads, was 11 at the time, and given the subject matter and the plot of the film, how do you go about working with young actors who may not necessarily understand everything that's in the script? Did you encounter that at all with Lola?
You know, there's one moment, no one's ever asked me that before, but there's one moment that I remember where Lola, you know, very politely raised her hand. I think that's the only time that's ever happened to me on a set. And she asked me a question like that. Something like, oh, but wait, if she's like this, what happened before this? And it was, you know, some horrible thing must have happened. And I think Lola's been exposed to a lot of, like, you know, horror scripts and stuff. I'm not sure that it's really that big a deal, but I started explaining it, and as I started explaining it, I was like, you know, this is just unpleasant, you know, this is just, and I just said, you know what, just do it. No, which is something I never say to an actor, but this was one, because I just didn't want to get into molestation and stuff, because the backstory of these characters, even though that's not what the film is about, both of these characters have, you know, it seems from the story, been abused. And I just didn't want to start getting into a whole conversation with a child actor about child abuse. You know, it didn't seem necessary in the moment. So that's the one time, I hope, that I'll give an answer like that, because it's not a cool answer, but I felt like the right answer at the time.
You know, you know, Lola's mom was also on set as well. And anytime you're working with a child actor, how much do you have to communicate with their parent or their chaperone? I'll be like, okay, this is, you know, this is what the film's about, or, you know, are you okay with everything in this script? Like, is there a conversation that happens with that other person, because they legally have to be on set until the child, I think 15.
I mean, every situation is different. Like, I shot another film with a child actor who was being attacked, you know, and I had to have a conversation with the mother who was present, and, you know, and we talked about it, and actually it's come up a couple of times, but in this film that didn't come up. I mean, everyone's different, and Lola, you know, is already a kind of an old soul and a veteran actor. I mean, she's in everything these days, and her mom is just super cool, and I don't mean cool in that she doesn't care and she just lets anything go, but I think she actually is clued in. And this film, I think, and I think she felt, has like, yeah, the material is very dark. It's a dark subject matter, but I never really saw it as a dark film for myself, even though obviously everything that happens in it is sort of dark. But for me, there's this sort of warmth to the soul of the film. And a lot of the worst things that happen off screen or in the past or what have you. So I just don't think they were super concerned, and I think they were right in this case not to be concerned. I think that if you were having a scene that depicted, you know, let's say Lola being violently abused as a child, I think there would have been,
right.
But that just wasn't, again, the kind of thing we were doing, so it didn't really come up as an issue.
Do you see the film then as almost a love story?
Yeah, in a way. I mean, but, you know, a love story is obviously a loaded term. So a love story traditionally is just a man and a woman. And then, you know, you have a great film like Brokeback Mountain, it's like a man and a man, you know? And then it's you know... But, I mean, obviously a love story could be about a father and a daughter. But because we have that attachment to romantic love... you know, that definitely makes it a little risky, and that brings in some of the issues you were talking about, like, is this like a pedophile, is this whatever. But I think the spirit of the film goes away from that direction and is sort of, even though everything that happens is dark, there's a warmth underneath that. Even if that warmth is totally imagined, because it doesn't even exist in reality, if this very isolated man believes it exists, that's something, that's a comfort to him. So I think that this relationship that develops between him and this girl is like more akin to the love between a father and a daughter. And you can call that a love story, if you choose.
One thing that really struck me, and maybe I just didn't notice it, but throughout when I was watching, the complete lack of musical score. At least in a lot of the scenes. What did that sort of background silence, how do you think that enhanced the story you were trying to tell and helped us really get into the minds of these characters? Because that's ultimately what the story is, I think.
Yeah, I think it's tricky. I mean, this is like sort of an aesthetic thing. I think from... a North American perspective in movie making, this is an extreme minimalist score, just like what you just said. From a European and even French Quebecois perspective, at least on the art house side, this is like way too much music. So our composer, who's from France, felt that this was already like a ton of music, you know? And so there was a sort of, you know, conversation about that. For me, the end result sort of goes with the feeling of the film. I mean, this is also a film that, you know, opposite most trends in like North American and commercial filmmaking, I mean, there's a lot of fixed shots. We're not trying to go at a fast pace. It's not supposed to be, there's no, very few jump scares. If this was a commercial project, we'd have jump scares every 2 minutes, you know? So I think it goes with that vibe. And the people who love the film, I think, get into that vibe. And then, you know, if you're looking for, I don't know, if you're looking for sort of like a slasher movie, I think you wouldn't like that vibe, right. You know? So it's sort of an aesthetic choice, you know? There's just like, there's not a ton of camera movement, you know, and that's, it's subjective, you know?
You mentioned pacing, and how much of that came out in editing and post? Because the film's only, I think, 78 minutes, but it's very sort of slow and deliberate.
It feels like 78 hours.
But yeah, no, how much of that, of the sort of the that slowness came out when you were shooting, and how much of that came out in the editing room?
You know what's funny is that there are people who come up to me after it and just say, I just was on the edge of my seat and I just couldn't breathe. It was so tense. And then there are other people who I'm sure have the exact opposite reaction. And I think some people get caught up in a certain tension in the atmosphere of the film. But the film, I can't really say if it reflects, if it's from the editing, because the script was like this too. I mean, in the script, there's not a lot of action scenes. You know, there's just like, this is a solitary man. There's not a lot of dialogue. There's not a lot of action. There are moments of action, you know, that come suddenly. But so, yeah, I think it was sort of like this from the beginning. Editing-wise, I mean, it's hard for me to say because I edited the film against my will. I didn't want to. We just ran out of money. I wanted to have an editor. So, it's really hard for me to pass judgment on my own, my own work. But it was always this kind of film. It wasn't like it became a new kind of film. That never happened.
You talked a lot in this interview about, you know, commercial filmmaking and commercial filmmaking in Canada. Where are you at with the state of the industry here? Because, you know, for every, you know, you have guys like, you know, Villeneuve now in Valais who are doing fantastic things, but then there's still, you know, guys like yourself or, you know, Bruce McDonald, you know, Sukyun Lee, who are, you know, keeping the smaller indie circuit alive. Where are you with the industry as a whole in this country?
Gee, that's a big question. I mean, for myself personally, you know, these sort of commercial or non-commercial, like, I couldn't care less. Like, I just either like a film or I don't. But, you know, I'm aware that to make a film, to get funding, you know, you have to be checking certain boxes sometimes not. So sometimes you need to have these, you know, but I mean, yeah, it doesn't really, you know, you mentioned Villeneuve, you know, he made a film I liked, Arrival, you know, which my sound designer on my film worked on that as well and won an Oscar for that, you know, and, you know, I guess that's a commercial film. I mean, that's a cool film. I mean, basically, you know, there's a lot of people doing interesting things. If there's an issue, it's always, with filmmaking, it's always money, you know, and now that there's fewer people making money off of films, fewer people going to cinemas, there's more, you know, piracy, there's less money, there's no DVDs anymore, things like that. I think it seems that budgets are getting smaller and smaller and smaller across the board, so it's harder for people to make a living making films. So I'd say that's probably the worrying trend in the industry. But in terms of, you know, what people are doing, and there's always, like you mentioned, a bunch of people doing cool things, and, you know, I don't think there's any shortage of that. I think it's really just resources that's the tricky part.
Well, the film is Touch, and it starts playing at the Carlton on November 16th for a one-week engagement. Carl Ahern, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
That was my interview with Carl Ahern, the director of Touch. The film is screening in Toronto right now. Select other cities to follow. My next guest comes all the way from Paris, France. He is part of the French vocal band, like a little bit electro mixed with a little bit of pop punk, Dot Legacy. They were recently in Toronto for Indie Music Week. He is Damien Quintard, and the band is Dot Legacy. Here is our conversation.
Daniel Quintard. Damien Quintard from the Dot Legacy. Hello, bonjour. Hello. Welcome to Canada.
Thank you so much.
How are you doing?
Great. To be honest, I'm a bit tired. Like, I have a huge jet lag in my
It's 1 in the morning when we're recording this. You guys just played your first show in Canada. How did it feel?
Great. I think we were expecting it to be something special because, yeah, it's our first time here. We've been around a lot, but we've been anticipating to come to Canada for quite some time now. And so, you know, we're happy it went well. And for us, it was really about learning how to talk to the Canadian public, which is very special. And so we're happy we've done this first step now.
How did it feel like flying all this way and then you guys played a 20-minute set?
Well, it's not really the goal that matters. It's the journey, you know?
Right, yeah.
And just living these moments as a band to, you know, come over and cross the world in order just to represent your music for all in all, like just an hour. I think it's something very beautiful. And it's just spreading the arts wherever we can and trying to make it beautiful. So we're very happy to do this. Even if we only played 5 minutes, we would have come. Yeah.
I was talking with Arnaud a little bit before the show about how we're sort of experiencing a little bit of a revival in the French music scene. You got Phoenix. How would you describe the scene in your home country right now?
Well, I mean, first of all, thank you for, you know, putting us in the same list as Phoenix and these guys. Of course, like, they're an inspiration for us. And, you know, the scene right now in France is very special. For me, it's divided in two categories. The first one is that there is the French chanson, you know, where you have artists singing in French and doing variété, you know. And there's the other scene that is more French touch, you know, Daft Punk, Phoenix, Justice. And what we want to do is try to, you know, go into this French touch realm and bring our pop rock touch into it. And so that's how we view the French scene. And it's kind of a challenge to go in France and do what we do. And but, you know, we're happy to try.
I was talking with Arnaud about how, you know, you guys sort of mix pop rock with electronic music. And electronic music is very, very, very big in France. At least that's our interpretation. Did you guys purposely set out to do something different, would you say, or did you sort of fall into it?
Well, I mean, we had the beginning of our musical career was mostly in the rock and roll, you know, but we were all lovers of the French touch. And people over our tours, over all the concerts, they all told us that we had this French touch vibe going on. And for this record, we just decided to listen to them and we wanted to explore this side. So it was more of a journey in our sound, and we discovered that we loved doing it. And so it's a first step for us, but we're really happy to take them.
I know, yeah, on that note, I know you guys recently rebranded yourselves kind of as artists. What goes into a decision like that?
Well, you have to think a lot, and you really have to try to not get high on your own supply, you know? And it's very easy as an artist to say, oh my God, I'm so good, and I love what I do. Because when you create something, you immediately fall in love, right? So we just had to take like a big step back and enjoy the things that we've done before, but really try to progress. So for us, it's not really so much of a rebranding, but it's more like a musical progression. If you hear the albums over and over, you see that we're going somewhere. And I think we finally found, after years and years of playing together and touring, what makes us really happy. And we're trying to share it now.
finding your artistic voice,
yeah.
How long was that process like for you guys?
It was very long, you know. The Legacy started playing together 11 or 12 years ago. We were kids. We waited 8 years until we said, okay, let's actually do an album. Yeah, we were not ready before. I don't even know if we're ready now, but we're trying. And so it's a long, long journey. For us, it's weird to say it, but the band just started now. We really feel like reborn, and we take the previous albums and the previous tours that we did as an experience and a heritage. And we're now trying to explore what our real potential is with this kind of music. Definitely.
I was talking with Arnaud about, like, I'm always interested in why European bands sing in English compared to their native language. What was that decision like for you guys to say we're gonna sing in English rather than French?
It was an easy decision for me because I lived like 12 years in Asia, so I learned to speak French and English at exactly the same time. You know, when I think, almost all the time I think in English. So it was not even like a decision for me, it was something natural. I respect a lot of people who sing in French. I think one day we might, but for me it's, you know, a progression, and I just felt it was natural for me to actually sing in English. And the band agreed with me on that, so we really didn't think about it. You know, when you listen to melody, the first thing that comes into mind has to come naturally. And it's really not about, oh, this is English or this is German, or I know the language of Wakanda. You know, it could be anything, yeah. As long as the emotions are going through the lyrics. So yeah.
How would you compare to playing in France versus playing here, where people, you know, to a foreign audience, they may not speak your language, they may not know you as well. Yeah. As an artist, how would you sort of compare those experiences?
Well, I mean, every country is different, right? That's why the first show was very special for us. It was very dear to us that we put our hearts into it. Because, you know, when you go to Brazil, you say, "Hello, Brazil," and everybody immediately goes crazy. And you didn't play a note, right? France is different too. I mean, you have to do a full concert and then they applaud. And, you know, it depends on the place you play, but it's a hard crowd. But it's also a beautiful crowd. And Canada, we're still learning. It's our first gig, but we're trying to define the contours of their perception of the music. And that's why, you know, it's the first time, you know. That's why I said be gentle with us. And it's very interesting. You guys have a very special way of listening to music. And we'll get to the bottom of it.
Are you guys enjoying Canada so far?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, maybe it's very cliche to say this, but the people are so nice. They're so helpful. And it's amazing, you know. It's a great experience. The venues are nice too. And we've been absolutely amazed by the reception we've had here. So many great people, and so many people that want to work with us and encourage us on our journey. And it's been amazing so far. Very cliche, but yeah, it's true.
As a band, how would you describe your writing process?
Well, you know, there is no rule. And if there is, you know, just literally shit on it, yeah? It can be like, you know, you're sleeping or you're brushing your teeth at 3 in the morning and there's a fucking melody that comes into your mind and you're like, huh, this could be something. Or we're in rehearsals, we rehearse a lot as a band, and, you know, a melody comes and we play on it and say, this could be like this. So it's really like a work, a teamwork. And then more and more we try to focus the music on the emotions and on the lyrics too, so that people understand a general message in the songs that we do. So it's everybody, you know, takes part, this is what I love, because it's really a symbiosis, you know, of different people and different energies. The hardest thing is, of course, you know, to make something beautiful, and also to not be completely out of the element, you know. I don't want to be Donnie in the Big Lebowski. So we really have to focus on not pleasing ourselves,
right,
but pleasing the music gods. And so it's a hard mixture, but we're always, always happy to give our utmost best and try to put some love into it.
I know that many members of the band play different instruments, like guitar and keyboards or drum and stuff, whatever. Do you know going into a song what instrument is going to be featured?
No. We have a general idea of the colors that we want to put in the sound, but sometimes the song must be rewritten 100 times before it takes its final form, because we composed hundreds of songs, and we're past that now. If we compose a song, it has to be able to have some kind of a hit factor to it. So we're not thinking about what should be in there, we're thinking about how people should feel when they listen to it. So if we had to add, if we have to add a harpsichord or, you know, some some noises or some guitar or anything, we think about it when we create it and not before, because it wouldn't make sense.
Yeah, yeah. So the song I got to sample was Fire Squad.
Exactly.
What can you tell us about that song?
Well, it's kind of our... it's a song that we're putting forward now because it resembles the most what we're trying to do. French Dutch mixed with pop rock. It's a very hard song to recreate, and to be able to recreate it, we need an amazing system. And we need to be in the best conditions in order to for the frequencies to flow. So this song is mostly about creating a space where people can discover this new thing that we're proposing, and you know, get a good tune and get all your energy into it. This is how we want to bring out the song. So it's interesting for us. We probably will play tomorrow.
I know tonight you guys had a little bit of an issue with your sound system.
Yeah.
As performers, how do you adjust to something like that?
Well, we have like different elements in our sets, and the idea behind the sound is to be able also to adapt to different places. Ideally, we would play, you know, in places where we can have the utmost best system, but sometimes, you know, in this scene, it's not always the case. So we have to adapt our sound, and we can do it very quickly. It's just a matter of seconds to say, this will not sound good, so let's do this song, this will. It's, you know, being flexible.
Yeah. And how important is it to you guys to engage and sort of have some sort of relationship with the audience, how, you know, however small or large it may be?
Well, I think if you're playing music, it's for them. Mostly it's about creating a space where people can live an experience. And, you know, with the digital things nowadays, it's always hard. So it's just, we always have to respect the way the public feel. Because if they don't feel anything, it's not your fault. I mean, it's not their fault. It's your fault. So we really have to work into making this a good experience for them, or something that makes a difference. So it's really about creating this emotional space around the music and around the singer, which is not always easy. But yeah, it's okay. I say music is really about emotions, and it's like when you read a book, or it's like when you listen to beautiful symphony.
Yeah,
there is this, you know, when you have a dream and you wake up and you want to talk about it, but you can't find the words. You know, this is when music comes along. music is the description of the substances that you dream of. So it's our responsibility to try to put it forward and make the people understand what we're doing. So it's, I think it's the hardest thing to do when you're on stage, and to make them enter into your universe, which is not always easy.
Do you guys have a favorite Canadian experience so far?
Donuts.
Donuts.
We really ate some amazing donuts. I mean, you know, it's, maybe it's bad to say food. I think like the best thing we lived through was the reception of the people in general. You know, when you go into bars, when you go into, you know, concert places, restaurants, the hotel, everybody's very helpful. So it's more like a general mood, and we're really thankful for it, because we understand like people don't owe us anything. And this is what's beautiful about Canada, is that they still give you joy and respect and their utmost best. And it's such a great thing, you know. I mean, congratulations, Canada. You won us over, like, by far. Well done.
Do you see a lot of similarities between Canada and France, or Toronto and Paris?
Well, you have good food here. Food again, they can stop it. Similarities. I would say maybe it's kind of the same, maybe everywhere, in the way that you can go to places where it's not amazing, but if you know the few places that are amazing and that bring you joy, then you can really get it here. In some countries, perhaps not, but Canada is definitely a place where you can express yourself. Like, I see that there's a real tolerance to music and to people that are different, and I really respect this. You see a lot of people in the streets with wigs, you see a lot of, you know, gay people that can express themselves freely, and I think it's really beautiful, and it's a node to what Canada represents, and I really dig it. Really.
Well, Daniel Bernard, thanks so much for your time tonight. I know you're exhausted.
Oh my God, I have no voice. I have to sing tomorrow.
Ciao.
See you guys. Thank you.
That's all for me to today. Short and sweet. Thanks for tuning in, and I will see you next time. Bye for now.